erroneous to the urgent condition of approval of 2040, and the other thing comes maybe 2050. So I think it's the challenge of the times, and we all need to, in our various roles, try to help the cause of reducing global warming. Just a quick recap, the International Sustainability Standards Board is working on issuing S1 and S2 by June of this year. The key decisions have been made and they're currently going through what they call a balloting process, where they're reviewing and rechecking everything. And then the IAASB, which Bill is on the task force on, is working towards the exposure draft in maybe June. And so then that's left with ISBA trying to do the ethics that will underpin the reporting and assurance. So the whole framework may be in place by the end of 2024, so that people can start reporting on it. So the way we will run this is I'll ask each of the panel members to make an opening statement, and then I'll have some follow-up questions, and then we can open it up for your questions as well. So I'll ask Mark to start us off with his opening statement. Mark?
Great, thank you, Chana. I'm really pleased to be here with you. Why is this so important? Well, sustainability information increasingly is being used for capital allocation decisions that previously were only driven by financial information. So therefore, in order to have confidence in that information, it needs to be as reliable, it needs to be as trustworthy as financial information. And part of the solution to that is the ethics and independence requirements that the Fed set. I think we should think of some of the other challenges as well about sustainability. In particular, you know, Chana just talked about the challenge that was set by the UN Secretary General. It requires companies to set out a medium or long-term path, and those medium or long-term paths are uncertain. And it's important, therefore, that there is a robust framework of ethics and independence, which means that that information is prepared in a way that people can have confidence with, people can have confidence in, that it's subject to the appropriate sort of checks and balances, and the people who are preparing and assuring that information are doing so with integrity. So this is a particularly important time for IESBA, and delighted to be leading the focus on independence and working with Chana and other colleagues. It is very important that we move with pace, which is something new to the standard-setting community from time to time. And of course, as part of our engagement in Sydney this week, it's really important that we do so and we meet the public interest challenge by getting insight and information from the government.
Thanks, Mark.
As Chana said, the ISSB's big forum, and they're going to issue S1 S2 by June of this year. That's on the reporting side internationally. I'm just going to give you a bit of an update on the assurance side internationally first, and many of you were at the ISSB roundtable we had earlier today, so I'll repeat a little bit of that if you excuse me doing that. Then I'll move on to what the AASB and AASB are doing here in Australia quite briefly. But probably the big thing for me to say is the AASB has made significant progress in drafting a sustainability assurance standard, ISSA 5000, which is based on existing literature in 3,034. I'm hoping you know the numbers I'm throwing out there. If not, just run with me. We produced a standard relatively quickly. It's an overarching standard, a standalone standard. It has 50 pages of requirements and 120 odd pages of application material, so it's a substantial piece of work, and it covers an engagement from end to end. The aim is for it to cover all sustainability topics, all frameworks, and as I said, the ISSB is probably the one that's most in people's mind at the moment. and it's practitioner neutral. It expects compliance with ethics and quality management, and we can talk at length about that later. It covers limited assurance and reasonable assurance, and there's quite a significant work in, area in it on using the work of others. There are certainly some difficult areas for us to address, which are in there, but further work needs to be done on materiality, forward-looking information, use of experts, and we definitely need more examples to help people come into this new area. But there is significant cooperation between IAASB and IESBA, and Mark and Chan can tell you about IESBA. And the aim is to have an ED by June this year, with a final standard by the end of 24. So everything comes into sync by the end of 2024. I hope everyone in this room realises the importance of having assurance on sustainability information. Otherwise, we're going to get a lot of information which I think people will lack some credibility. Many of you may know there was a Treasury consultation during the early part of this year on two things, one being the role of the AASB to develop or issue, to develop sustainability reporting standards for Australia, and also there's consultation on reporting on climate change. Bearing in mind, climate change is just the first step in the sustainability journey. That Treasury consultation got 200 submissions, which is the most Treasury have ever got on any consultation paper across any discipline. So there's a lot of interest there, and we didn't even mention the ISSB got 1,400 submissions for its international reporting standard. There's general support, the Treasury consultation showed there's general support in Australia for an international baseline reporting standard. There's a bit of mixed views on who what standard setting structure should exist in Australia. As I said, the AASB are initially doing it and will continue to do it even until a separate board is formed, but that's still a question to be answered. Although larger companies are currently reporting voluntarily, and many companies are still very underprepared, and even audiences like this, I think the message is hard to get out to people, all the developments that are happening at the moment that companies need to get prepared for. As for the AASB, I'll just explain that they are awaiting the ISSB standard in June, but they're ready to go on that when they're with a due process framework, which is based on the IFRS framework, and they have criteria for when they might depart from the ISSB standard. And I think most of you who are across the standard know that the appendix on some of the SASB metrics is pretty extensive, and that probably won't be picked up in Australia. And we have our own local requirements for greenhouse gas emissions, which may be different as well. The UASB, which I chair, we will definitely follow the IAASB sustainability assurance standard. I forgot to mention the AASB now has three members on it with sustainability experience. The AUASB now has two members on it with sustainability experience. So clearly, and we're supporting that with staff in both offices. So there's going to be significant outreach from the assurance point of view for the second half of this year with respect to the assurance standard, and certainly from the international point of view and from the Australian point of view. So I hope that gives you a bit of an insight on how much is happening and happening relatively quickly in standard setting terms, and I look forward to maybe having some questions later.
Thanks, Bill. Marge, if you can give your opening statement. Thanks.
I also have some notes. One, I'm going to talk about three things. I'll tell you about what's been going on with climate standards in New Zealand, where we're at with that. I want to talk to you a little bit about what ISO are doing, give you a bit of an idea about that. I'll explain who they are if you don't know. And then talk a little bit about my perspective as a sustainable professional for well over 35 years, 40 years now. So this is not new stuff for me. It's been around for a long time. But I'll begin with comments on New Zealand's climate standards and what's the context there. So the financial sector Climate-Related Disclosures and Other Matters Amendment Act in 2021 establish mandatory climate disclosures for a range of listed entities and financial organisations, about 200 organisations. It extended the XRB's mandate to issue standards for those disclosures, and that follows on with assurance standards over those disclosures. So in December 2022, the XRB, the External Reporting Board in Australia, issued disclosure standards based on TCFD after several rounds of extensive consultation to ensure they were appropriate in the New Zealand context and in the context of our regulatory disclosure regime. Earlier this month, the XRB was awarded the Australasian Market People of the Year Award at the King & Hughes Deep Capital Markets for this work. So it's nice to be recognised in Australasia. It is quite new thinking. Disclosures are required for periods beginning in January this year. So moving to the assurance context, which is more what we're talking about tonight, there's important things to be aware of in New Zealand. And that has informed the approach the XRB has taken to the assurance standards. So assurance over disclosure is mandated on the greenhouse gas emissions disclosures for periods that end in October 2024. This will be limited in this instance. New Zealand has established an assurance provider with 20 years experience in this market operating using ISO standards, including ISO 40,064-3, and with accreditation from JASANS. JASANS is a joint accreditation service Australia New Zealand, so it's a treaty-based government-to-government organisation within New Zealand and Australia. That is in addition to accountant assurers using the ICA 3000-3410 standard. There are many moving parts in the New Zealand context. Just as there's been consultation here in Australia, there's been consultation by NB about proposals to extend the scope of assurance of all this, the climate disclosures, but also around proposals for who should regulate and license climate auditors. So there's been some similar discussions going on. Those have not been resolved yet. We're still waiting to see what comes out of that consultation process. There's also significant work being done by ISO, the International Organisation for Standardisation. This is a really big deal. ISO has been around for 70 years, writes standards on a manner of things, and has several thousand standards, probably 50,000 standards, and has a whole suite, many suites of standards on environmental sustainability matters. So they have been doing some work on this area, and I managed to catch up and get a latest update just yesterday from Graham Drake, who's based here in Australia and is one of the conveners of the project that ISO was working on around a standard for verification and validation of sustainability information. This will build on existing standards that we have had in place for many years. The project's been approved and is moving at some pace. Committee nominations for up to four experts from each of the member country standards organisations are closing on the 4th of April. Their first meeting's happening on the 17th and 18th of April, and a second in-person meeting in May over several days. They're going to produce an umbrella standard, which will be, we have to have numbers here, ISO 40019. That will be done in parts. The first part will be a general requirements standard, the second part about verification of quantifiable historic information. Those are the first two caps that we're working off the rank. And following that, three more parts. Verification of qualitative historic information. Then a standard on validation of future estimates and quantified information. And a fifth one on validation of future information of a qualitative nature. So quite comprehensive. Pleased to say that we've managed to establish some links between ISCA and ISB with ISO at a very senior level, so board level, and with the General Secretary of the whole ISO organisation. So there are some discussions going on about how to liaise over these quite differently parallel projects involving a range of different practitioners. So numbers two and three, some very brief comments. My perspective is an non-accountant, sustainability practitioner and assurer, and I've been doing this a long time. So since the late 80s, writing standards, auditing performance as a consultant, certification standards, setting up and running New Zealand certification program for 14,000 online management systems, getting that accredited by JASANS, running the New Zealand National Label Program, that's run by the government, which involves writing standards and then auditing for licensing people who use the government's label on products and services. Involved in training auditors and assurer of sustainability reports over a period of time with a number of clients. I would say it's a really, really wide world. There are many standards and frameworks over a myriad of types of information in this ISO, this non-accounting world. They cover management systems, they cover labels for products, eco-labels or services and processes. They cover how accreditation happens for an independent certification or assurance, as you would see it. Independent testing and inspections that we all take for granted, but underpin the entire of our economies. How we understand when we buy something that weighs a kilogram, that is actually a kilogram, through to new test products before they can release to the market, a whole range of things are important there. It is actually quite a jungle when we get into not just these standards that are done by government-related or government-accredited organisations, but of NGO and civil society standards and labels. I did some work back when, only 20 years ago for our Ministry of Economic Development at the time, which provided a database of well over 400 different eco-labels available on the market. All of them have different types of credentials. But lots of the stuff is very, very mature. It's independent and it's well-credentialed. It's recognised in the International Trade Agreement, so it's part of that whole world that was established as part of the Bretton Woods arrangement. And it is recognised in national regulatory arrangements, which frequently refer to ISO standards and accredited testing and the like. Some of the standards, I have to say, have lesser or no credentials. That's the jungle. Things you might find are very on products and things we make in marketing. Much of the work of this whole world of independent assurance practitioners, and there are hundreds of thousands of these people around the world, will form the basis of information that were reported in sustainability. Because it will be based on measurement, testing, product claims, compliance with standards, frameworks, and all sorts of things. So there's a whole world of independent assurance already happening over lots of input to this material that's hardly disclosed. And indeed, there are practitioners who are assuring those reports now using ISO-type standards. So, my personal view, it's really important to recognise, to understand, and to know when and how to rely on the successful body of peer practitioners' work when you're completing assurance over border information, or if you're involved in assisting them with doing that assurance. You absolutely will require a range of highly specialised experts to help you navigate the range of matters that we cover in sustainability reports, and they're there. They're out there, they're doing it now, they'll be doing it for decades. So be curious. You'll also need to be thinking about considering how to and when to work an integrated assurance team with these people. These practitioners, it would, in my view, and it should, be the way of the future, because it can't hang off one practitioner leading these very complex teams. So I think that's a good thing we need. So my advice to the accounting profession, be genuinely curious about this parallel, credible world. Find out about it. You're going to need these people. It will be important to provide trust and Codlands in the Board of Sustainability Information to meet the needs of a very wide range of users and stakeholders, interested parties, for whom it is prepared and assured, not just investors, consumers, non-profit investment decisions, contract arrangements, right through from them. So be curious, pursue this, be respectful, and a little bit humble.
Thanks, Marge. And I think just to on your point about non-accountants being involved in it, I mean, that's why both the ISBA and the IAASB is looking at it from a practitioner perspective and professional agnostic perspective, recognizing that there has been other people before that and trying to see how we can work together and collaborate. And last but not the most important person who will have to monitor and enforce this in Australia, Doug, how about your opening statement?
A few opening comments from me. As a securities regulator, exciting and challenging times, as others have mentioned. What has been happening really quickly, though, I was reflecting on, it was about 4 years ago, there was an ISCO meeting Sydney, and there was a presentation about sustainability and how there are 400 frameworks internationally. That's interesting. There are 400 countries in the world. And so things have moved very quickly towards narrowing that down. I'm not suggesting that we don't end up with one framework, but IOSCO and ASIC are very supportive of the initiatives being made by the ISSB and towards adopting a global baseline. And as you probably gathered, very supportive of the work of the IAASB and the IASBA as well. As a securities regulator, it's interesting, I should start by saying regulators are structured differently in different countries. And so in many countries you have a securities regulator, you have another financial reporting regulator, board oversight regulator. In Australia, it's all one. So one thing we've worked out is that ASIC is going to have a pretty important role in regulating in this area. And it's all coming fairly quickly. Now, the periodic corporate reporting, the assurance on that, the ethics requirements are very key to this. Obviously, we're interested in other areas, you know, greenwashing, the carbon markets. So, in fact, sustainability is actually now one of the top eight, well, there are only eight, maybe 8 plus 1, if you add in ASIC security systems, I didn't mention that. But if sustainability is one of the 8 strategic priorities of ASIC. And so you can see that that's very important to us and is getting a lot of attention at the moment. I guess in that area, I sort of touched on the international, and it's very important to us as well. We've always been very supportive of the other basic principle of securities regulation, which is about confident and informed markets and investors. Financial reporting is a key part of that, and the assurance on that contributes to the quality. But of course, how important financial reporting is, it's only part of the picture, and the sustainability fills it out. And I'm still somebody thinks enterprise value, I'm not about to use that term, but that's a fairly key part of getting this whole picture of the company and all the different elements to it. Understandably, climate first is the approach that's being taken now. At IOSCO, again, it's a key priority. So IOSCO has formed Sustainability Task Force, which we're involved in, and it has various streams. One is the Technical Review Committee, which I'm involved in, and its various work streams, which has been working with the ISSB around its standards. There's also an assurance work stream, very importantly, which I'm also involved in. The assurance work stream is important because it put out a statement which was put out by the IOSCO board, which was supportive of the work of the International Standards Centers, that's in September, and this week put out a further report on sustainability assurance, which you can get from the IOSCO website. Prepared for that one, and I'll come back to that in a moment. So IOSCO is working towards endorsement of the ISSB standards. So And let me just go back and ask a terrible question. So, what was the most important event to occur in Sydney in the year 2000? And if you're thinking the Olympics, you're wrong. It was the Oscar endorsement of the IFRS accounting standards. And why was that important? Because endorsement is a message to securities regulators, conjunctly members in IOSCO, about supporting the adoption of those standards in their jurisdiction. Now, not necessarily every jurisdiction has adopted that. Fairly widely adopted and has improved over time. And so that's why endorsement is seen as important. To be honest, we've never endorsed the ISAs or the Code of Ethics. So there's some interesting questions around how we express support for the process there. I can't help but throw in, and it's not entirely assurance, digital reporting. So, by the way, we never actually endorsed taxonomy for digital reporting. Probably a good reason for that. When we were endorsing the IFRS accounting standards, there was no taxonomy to endorse. But we are looking at whether we endorse the ISSB's taxonomy. I might go back and endorse the financial reporting taxonomy. And I shouldn't forget, I touched on IOSCO, IFIA, International Forum of Independent Audit Regulators, a little bit slower than IOSCO in the pickup on sustainability, which is understandable because IOSCO covers the range, covers financial reporting and audit, the whole range of securities regulation, whereas IFIA is about the assurance component. Generally speaking, assurance follows frameworks, developing framework neutral standards. So there is now a sustainability task force in IFIA, and so the life of IOSCO focused on standards in the assurance space, and ethics. And we also have a working group, the Global Quality Working Group, which meets with the firms. So the topic there is about what they're doing internationally in terms of preparedness and picking up the standards in due course. So I guess that's sort of a bit of background on sort of the framework and so forth. I know I'm not meant to speak too much about reporting, but the objective at the moment with the ISSB standards due to come out at the end of June, we'll start looking at a draft of those in April, line-by-line review, with a view to endorsement, not sure exactly when, probably a couple of months after the ISSB standards come out, all going well, of course. Now, when it comes to adoption in Australia, Bill mentioned the Treasury consultation paper, and obviously Treasury is the one that advises government and they make decisions. You probably gathered with the change in government, the Treasurer is very supportive of climate reporting particularly, and so Treasury is well resourced to have a look at all the various areas. The standards are important, all the different standards. There will be other components that need to be addressed as well, scientific analysis, transition, disclosures, and so forth. So there's a lot of work that's going on in that area. And I should mention the Council of Financial Regulators. There's so many groups here and acronyms and so forth. But the Council of Financial Regulators, OSCO is a member along with APRA, the Reserve Bank, and Treasury. That's playing a key role in terms of some of the oversight of the governance around this in a formal basis. We keep going on many subjects, but just to say, in terms of the adoption, it's not happening very quickly. We're thinking about what messages we give around implementation after the ISSB standards are adopted. Very keen to that is all the things that everyone probably knows about. Well, first off, voluntarily, we've been encouraging use of the TCFD recommendations. If you're doing it voluntarily, should we flip over and say, oh, the ISSB standards are there, you should be looking at using those even before they may become mandatory. And so that's something we're thinking about. But also the messages, and it's not that hard to figure out, very similar to the messages we give on the new accounting standards, major new accounting standards about what you do in the transition to those standards, the systems, the process, the implementation of preparedness, although this is so much bigger than we've had before, but the insurance industry might disagree with me about it.
Sure.
management scandal. But yes, there's a lot that people need to do throughout the whole ecosystem. You know, standards is a key role. It's the insurance providers. It's the people who are doing reporting. And we're at a time which is quite challenging. Chance again to call my me on time, by the way, Your Honor, but quite challenging in terms of resources. We have particular resource pressures during COVID-19. A lot of that's freed up, but a lot of work is being done by the firms, which is great, and others, but there's still a lot of work to do on upskilling. Where are all the resources coming from? Retaining people, where do people in commerce get their skills from? Films as well, and so there is an enormous amount still to be done. So it's exciting times. Investors are really demanding the information. They want the assurance of credible information, but there's a lot that everyone in this room can do to contribute to that, and so that is really important. I'm going to keep going, Chandra, unless you stop me, so perhaps I had better stop.
Thanks, Doug. Mark, I might go to you first. Why is developing a robust ethical framework important from an investor's perspective on sustainability reporting and assurance?
So ultimately, it comes down to confidence in information. You want to know, you know, as I've said before, you've got to be able to place reliance on the information that's being developed. And In many cases, this is new information being presented in a different way, being presented in accordance with a developing framework, drawing on a more diverse range of skills and experiences of the people who will play a part in this information being pulled together and this information being assured. So therefore, you know, ethics and independence is particularly important to ensure that, you know, that we've got information that is worth placing reliance on. So of course our focus from an IESBA perspective is how do we do that? One of our early decisions was to say people at the moment can place trust and have confidence in audited financial information. So therefore one of the things we should do in developing the Code for Sustainability Engagements is apply the same high benchmark that applies to an audit to the preparation and assurance of sustainability information. I think one of the things we've got to be really careful about Channa is you've heard about the, you know, very quick expansion of sustainability information. It grows with pace and it moves with pace. So therefore it's also incumbent on all of us to say from a public interest perspective, what are our priorities? And our priorities from an IESBA perspective are to say, well, if we're going to develop the code, we need criteria to say what are the things we need to respond to first. And we've taken a decision that the way we're going to respond first is to say, firstly, we'll look at developing the code to look at the preparation and assurance of information under a general purpose framework. And secondly, we'll focus on information that is used by investors, by the public, by stakeholders for decision making, either because it sits in an annual report, or because it's used by companies to report to financial markets, or because it meets a legal or regulatory requirement. So one of the things about us moving fast is we've got to look at those areas where it's most important to underpin confidence, that high standards of ethical behaviour and high standards of integrity and independence are fundamental to that. And we need to also, in that, reflect the fact that sustainability information draws in a much wider pool of people than just professional accountants. And so our challenge is, regardless of who does this work, the same high standard needs to apply.
And I guess that's why we are also looking at writing it in a professionally agnostic manner, acknowledging that there would be others other than accountants.
Absolutely. We've got to say that, Marge has given us lots of examples of different types of sustainability work. We know from the work that we've already done on benchmarking that the code is a high standard. but we need to make sure that that code is relevant and accessible to other people playing in that sector. A really good illustration of that is, if you go to certain jurisdictions, like, say, South Korea, 90% of the work in this sector is done by people who are not professional accountants or auditors. If you go to other jurisdictions, the exact opposite applies. More than 90% of the work is done by professional accountants and auditors. So if we are to serve our mandate, which is as the standard setter of a global code, which could be globally adopted, we need to reflect the fact that it's not just a narrow pool of people who are using this, and therefore being able to make the code accessible and having it there as an important public interest resource is going to be absolutely vital.
Yeah. Thanks, Mark. Bill, I might turn to you. So there are multiple reporting frameworks on sustainability, SASB, GRI, TCFD, at times it's referred to as alphabet soup. So with the work of the ISSB, what is the likely outcome at the global level with these various reporting frameworks?
Now, this is a question no one knows the answer to, so I'm going to have a go at answering it. I think the various international organisations, which were the alphabet soup, coming together at a very quick pace in 2021, was enormous in terms of trying to get some comparability and consistency around information to be presented. And that formed the ISSB very quickly. And then following off that, you see there's a lot of other developments happening quickly as well. All I want to stress is that it has to keep going very quickly. If we slow down, and the irony is that we're talking about sustainability. So you can't really sit back and take 20 years to actually take action in this regard. So it has to move quickly. Having said that, at the moment, there are so many variables in the place, and right down to sustainability reports are separate from annual reports. In some cases, they're included in annual reports. In other cases, people are talking about integrated reports. And sometimes it's a small piece of information that's assured only, not the entire sustainability. So there's a lot of things to be done. We've got, as has been mentioned already, a talent shortage in this area. And we're only starting on climate change. There are so many other topics to go. So where's it all going is a very hard thing. I think it's a fair summary based on all the evidence I've seen, is that the end game is to have one report which includes both financial and sustainable information assured by the single practitioner. And that may or may not be integrated reporting, those who know understand that framework. But having said that, we've got many things to do at the moment. We've only focused on financial impact, and there are many other frameworks out there like GRI, and indeed the Europeans are looking at both financial impact, well, it's a mandate, financial impact and the broader impact. So there's still a lot of questions to be answered, but I think what I just described as the final picture is there. Now, whether it be in 3 years or 20 will depend simply on how quickly we respond right now.
Thanks, Bill. Doug, yesterday IOSCO issued a report about expectations on the standards setters and the assurance framework. Could you give a few high-level points on that?
So the report did come out this week, and I certainly commend reading of the report. It covers messages around considerations for standard setters, investors, issuers, and also assurance providers, and so it's covering a large part of the ecosystem. In terms of standard setters, probably wouldn't come as a surprise, the focus is on the IOSB and IESBA, and also reiterating the messages around framework neutral and practitioner neutral standards, and that's understandable because OSCO is a global organisation, we're trying to cater for all different climates, so I don't personally disagree with Bill about the desire of, and the benefits of having perhaps the Audit and Financial Report, you know, sign off on both components. It might be a bit ambitious to think about both components being in one document. They certainly need to work together for to come, give a story. But getting back to the IOSCO report, I certainly would think it's worthwhile looking at the issue as part. While it's about assurance, all the things that the issuers, issuers being an international term, but the corporates can do to support the adoption, the preparedness, the implementation, upskilling within the organisations, thinking about the challenges around data, the scope 3 emissions, they're all incredibly important. We also borrowed some messages from, I actually started with an asset guide, 196, information sheet 196, which is about how directors can support audit quality. That ultimately became also an IOSCO document, and that's something that's important to think about in the sustainability area as well. How you support audit quality in terms of making sure they have appropriate skills and challenges going on about that part. But also it does cover the assurance providers and even some thoughts about what IOSCO's role is going forward. So I should keep it short, but I think the IOSCO process is quite important in terms of encouragement for assurance and the ethical standards without actually going to the step of endorsement. So definitely have a look at the report.
Thanks, Doug. Marge, you heard Mark speak about another example in Korea where 90% is done by non-accountants, and we have a similar situation in New Zealand where a lot has been done by non-accountants. We sort of have the reverse in Australia where, at least in the listed space, it seems like a lot more accountants are involved in it. So what do you think the challenges would be as all these frameworks come into place for practitioners in general?
I think it's recognising the process here is to build trust and confidence in information, and that trust and confidence is needed for financial markets, but it's needed much more widely than that. So it includes contract relationships, business-business relationships, consumer decisions, a range of things. I think being aware that this is not a matter of a very narrow focus in the bigger picture, and the impact of what organisations are doing on the planet and people is also very important. So at the moment we've got a focus wearing specifically on investors, but it's a small part of the challenge. So challenging people. I didn't tell you more about how we've managed some of this challenge with our climate standard. So the XRB's intention has been to be profession agnostic and recognise these two different regimes, the two different frameworks and the confidence that they provide. What we've done is produced what we're calling, it's an exposure draft at this point, a temporary standard, which is designed to test and learn how these different frameworks work and to get some effects of comfort for the wide consumer market about different practitioners using different standards. So it recognises the assurance of climate information, which is just the very simple first leg of what sustainability will involve. SCOTUS require this wide range of expertise. There aren't enough orders to do what financial orders need to do already. It's a bit challenge already. So we've worked closely with a panel of members from non-accountant and accounting practitioners. We've completed some quite detailed analysis of the requirements of the two different standard worlds for the engagement and understanding the wider support around credibility, ethical standards and the like. So the key features of our exposure draft are about engagement requirements, which require at least one or other of these two standards, the ISO standard or the ISO standard. And we've included some additional requirements on the report, which would reflect our regime and context in New Zealand. We have applied at principal level information and requirements on ethics, we have not sought to require compliance with PES1, which is the New Zealand version of the ISO code, and we've plucked out the principles, and those principles are common across the two regimes. And we've included principle-based quality management requirements and not specifically requiring compliance with ISQ standards. And that recognises these other practitioners have equally robust quality and ethical requirements. They just look a bit different than those accountants. So, you know, it is about recognising and surfacing the level these two different regimes, and that will be more important as we get to a wider range of issues.
Thanks, Marge. Bill, I might throw a question to you about what matters should boards and those charged with governance think about as they ready themselves for the sustainability reporting and assurance regimes?
Well, it's, I think it follows on from what I said earlier. We've got a lot, there's a lot of preparation to be done. There's a lot of preparation to be done by a lot of companies, and I think the key thing is to get it on the agenda right now. To get everyone in this audience, I just urge you to get involved in it in whatever role you might have. I mean, your large corporations are voluntarily reporting already, but even when standardisation comes in internationally, they'll have to change their disclosures to some degree, and others will have to start the process, and that's going to take some time. It's more importantly that they're going to have time to have systems and controls to underlie that reporting. You can't just pick the figures from the air. You're going to have to develop those within the organisation. As we've said already, there are going to be new skill sets we need to bring into organisations, and boards have to make sure that their organisation can see where that's coming from. If they do have skill sets other than accounting, or other than in their finance function, they'll have to combine those within the finance function, or combine the sustainability processes with finance processes. So a lot to be done. So I go back to simply saying, they've got to get going now, and it is a concern that I don't think the message is getting out as clearly or as widely as we'd like in Australia, despite what we've said this evening.
Thanks, Bill.
You forget one thing, though. There is one thing which is concerning directors, is liability, and that the liability of this information may come back to hurt them. And we do need to manage that and recognise that. But again, it's an issue about balancing the speed to try and get it out there, and that people are going to get better at it over years, versus unfortunately having to look over your shoulder at the legal requirements. So that is a major issue that boards have to address.
Thanks, Bill. So I have a few more questions, but I think I will stop there, and in the interest of time, open it up to any questions you might have. Yes, Carol.
Thank you. So I'm a chartered accountant and a professor of accounting. Companies have been reporting social and environmental information since the 1970s. Research in the field has been going on really since that time, and it has been undertaken by accounting academics. So there's a whole field of research by accountants, accounting academics who are qualified accountants in sustainability reporting that is going on, has been going on. The GRI is 25 years old. Its Global Sustainability Standards Board, established in 2016, was built from the guidelines that had been going on before that, and many Australian companies are already using the GRI standards. And so, you know, there is already a lot of expertise within companies. It is in different parts of companies, but it is there because of the GRI standards that companies are using. And those of us who have been researching this and working in this area, like Marge, since the 70s or 80s, and I started in the early 90s, we see that companies are doing this and have been doing this for some time because they believe it's important to a range of stakeholders. And we've been wondering why the accounting professions and the regulators have been sort of so slow to get into this area. The accounting professions are just starting to train accountants in this area and starting to think about and incorporating it into the sort of financial world of standards. But in terms of, so we can see it's all new and it's exciting and, the capital markets want to get into it and have the financial materiality side. And we've been wanting that to happen for a long time. But companies are also really, really wanting to report to a broad range of stakeholders. So, there may be an idea that there's going to be one report with sustainability and financial information in it. And many companies are already doing that with some supplementary information on their website. So to fulfill the GRI requirements, you can put that information anywhere. So, it's kind of companies will decide what they want to put in their annual report, what they think is most important for them. And they're already doing that, and they will continue to do that. And it won't necessarily be what they're told to put in them. They'll put in what they're told to put in them, but they'll put in additional information as well that they think is important. So I'm sorry, that's not so much of a question, but I guess a little sort of frustration that some of the history and the development seem to be missed. And it's not just about capital markets. It's about companies also wanting to report to a broad range of stakeholders, and investors also recognizing that that is important as well. Because stakeholders are what, the value of a corporation depends on its stakeholders and what they think of the corporation.
Can I address that statement or question? I'm not sure which one it was, Carol. I agree with everything you said, but it's important to understand that this alphabet soup I mentioned before has been around for 20, 30 years. The various organisations that are all been making an attempt to define sustainability frameworks, and it wasn't until we got them together we started to get an international baseline, if you like. Similarly, you're quite right. Companies will voluntarily and have been voluntarily disclosing, and some companies have expertise in over 20 years. All that is exactly right. But the one thing that's going to make a difference is that, I said earlier, I don't think we're dealing about investors, right? And initially, and investors want information which is reliable, and if that information is to be reliable, it needs to be based on a standard, it needs to be consistent, it needs to be comparable, and it needs to be assured. So that's where your argument fails a little bit, because you're quite right, because that's what we need. We can have other information disclosed. Same, but now companies now produce an annual report, which is terrific, audited, assured, and investors rely on it. But they also produce 10 other reports that they don't get assured, and they give the analysts a report. They issue a sustainability report. They issue various other reports which are not assured. Now, I don't think I'm the only person in the room that believes reports which are assured have more credibility than reports that are not assured. Now, analysts rely on their analyst reports. Good luck to them. That's a free market. Good luck to them. But I do think the big part about all that is the regulation. That's what regulation's about, is to ensure the protection of investors. And we can't protect everybody in the community, because at the moment we're talking about financial reports at the moment, the financial reporting system.
And Mark, would you like to add from a UK perspective?
Yeah, I will. So, absolutely agree with Bill about the importance of consistent, comparable information. And that's the challenge here. We have an obligation to try and support the production of high-quality information for decision-making. So, at a conference a couple of weeks ago, someone stood up about a large company and they said, we have a sustainability report that is over 100 pages long. I don't see that's a good thing, because is that decision useful? Is that actually, it's a lot of information, but is it meeting the immediate needs of the users of that entity's information. It's not. And one of the challenges for all of us in responding to this very significant expansion of reporting frameworks, looking at sustainability, but more widely in the ESG space, is we have an obligation to integrate that into a package of decision-useful information. And a package of decision-useful information doesn't begin with 600 pages.
Yeah, much.
Yeah, I've got a slightly different perspective here, and I noticed your little badge, because no one's yet mentioned the Sustainable Development Goals. So, you know, what is important here? So, you put the challenge earlier about climate, and are we responding and making the changes we need to look after our climate? The financial report are part of that, but what is happening with the UN Sustainable Development Goals is their impact standards, which is not about just the financial stuff, it's about what are people and organisations that are doing to address the Sustainable Development Goals. Not just line those logos up in your report where they seem relevant, but what are you actually doing to make the difference on those global goals? And that is the sort of area where GRI and this broader reporting on impact will still be very important, because that will be how we measure whether we are achieving those global commitments or not. The financial stuff will be vital about how we motivate and move capital, but it will only be part of the story. So it's just a little bit of balance.
Yeah, thanks, Mum. Okay. And I want to talk about the greenwashing cases that ASIC has been
involved in. Just very briefly, not to disagree with anything. I think one of the challenges in reporting, because we've already got the operating financial, which talks about business strategy and prospects, principles-based recognition measurement requirements work really well. Not so well necessarily with disclosures. And so, for the upcoming financial field, we've already said you need to cover the, you know, the climate risk of waiting the financial report, because someone says you need to cover the financial report already for impairment asset values, provisioning, and so forth. And it covers the ESG for the operating and financial review. We also mentioned looking at integrated reporting. But you need the global baseline to get that consistency and comparability. It doesn't take away anything that has been said by Carol and others about. You still need to be able to tell a story, and it's got to be flexible, and so don't take that away either. I guess I'd better stop there on that one and get to greenwashing. And by the way, the periodical reporting and assurance is going to be pretty important to the greenwashing question as well. Partly because, you know, the requirements around transition plans and disclosure there. But greenwashing more generally, last year ASIC put out an information sheet. I'm trying to get to put in a number, 271. Have a look at that. It was actually around greenwashing and disclosures for superannuation and for investment managers, although to some extent the principles are things to think about more broadly. It's built off the general comment in the Corporations Act about misleading information. But it goes further, it talks about, you know, labelling, how you describe the products, you know, your investment strategies. It's talking about, you know, superannuation, investment management. But definitely greenwashing is a priority as part of that, you know, that eight priorities for ASIC, and a lot of resources are going into it. It's not specifically my area, but there's also something being focused on by the ACCC. And so there's already four outcomes that are public. For the media releases, we'll probably put out an omnibus on it. But you know, it's something that we continue to focus on. You know, we're actively looking for cases, but we're also, to be honest, getting people coming to us and saying, oh, have you seen this? So, you know, directors, our corporate governance and everything else need to focus on these things as well. And, you know, perhaps I could talk about transition plans and everything else, but again, I better stop because we're going to run out of time.
Let's see whether there are any other questions.
Yes. Yep, I've got a question. As an engineer and an aspiring CPA, I often have an ethical sort of dilemma about AI, so artificial intelligence. And today it's a lot of the value of AI is reflected in cryptocurrencies. So whenever there's a market risk, we use AI plus cryptos. Now, from your point of view as experienced, you know, managers I'd like to learn from, like, how do you see the future of this risk management of AI, risk management of the market using AI and crypto? So where's the future for that with FX?
Well, you ask a really interesting question, because I think there are two schools of thought. One is that you absolutely hone in on the risk that the areas that you set out pose and try and address them, because it's a public interest issue to address them. The other school of thought is it's impossible to address them effectively, so you almost leave them outside of any sort of suggestion that you're able to provide a significant level of regulatory or ethical or otherwise protection around them. And that just goes to show that, you know, this is still a very fast developing world. And, you know, on your specific question on AI rather than crypto, you know, we are still in audit largely using an assurance model that's predicated not on an AI type environment. And one of the challenges we often discuss from an audit context is AI might produce for you evidence, but you have to assess whether or not it's sufficient appropriate audit evidence. So when you look at something that goes through a machine learning process, it might be appropriate at the time you evaluated it, but at what point do you have to re-evaluate it, because the machine learning continues to iterate and develop it? And, you know, that's probably not a solution that Bill and I can work out over a glass of wine later, but it is one of those fundamental sort of issues that standard setters and regulators are going to have to turn their minds to. Because, you know, some of the challenges that we have is we are facing issues where you can't stretch the existing model far enough to accommodate everything. And you might get to a point where you actually have to start to re-engineer to say these are things that were never actually considered at the point at which the approach we have was developed. So therefore, you know, what new approach is necessary to do that? So, you know, I'm always fascinated by that, and one of the things that we've talked about sort of in our discussions with the round table earlier today is, you know, quite often you're looking at trying to respond to the challenges of using different insights, different experts, you know, different experiences to provide assurance when you're developing information and when you're assuring information. But some of those evaluations can be right at one point in time and then completely be undermined at the next step. And so therefore it requires really careful thought and consideration about how we overcome that in a way that people can have confidence in.
But do you think that should actually mean appreciation of the crypto market when there's a difference? I mean, that's the ethical dilemma. Regulators are finding it difficult as well to say cryptos in, cryptos out, because the risk element that actually captures. And often the difference is in any kind of crypto, but moving forward with regulation, do you feel I should hedge a risk looking at the future of crypto?
So based on a very partial slice of your question, I don't feel, personally, I could revisit that until the IASB gets to a position where they can revisit whether or not what crypto has to do to meet a classification as a financial instrument. Because remember, at the moment, the classification of crypto is as an intangible, because there is no link to the underlying asset and liability that sits within crypto. So until you cross a threshold where that's possible, I don't believe you can do it. Now, that might happen with central bank-backed crypto, where people feel that there is a stronger link to an underlying asset, but I genuinely struggle, and I say it's purely personal view, but I genuinely struggle to see how you cross that until we get sufficiently far down the road that you can change the recognition
of crypto as an asset for accounting purposes.
Well, if I could just quickly mention eight strategic priorities. Crypto is one of them, impressive. But exposure of the large listed crypto is not at all. It's exposure at smaller end of the market. Other areas like AI is pretty important as well, something we all need to think about. At the moment, for example, ASIC was another one that used options, maybe a particular bracket, or an actual one, but it's still something that we're thinking about and assist. They don't want students using it because, and particularly entering exams, but in South Australia, they're coming, of course, clearly quite, the bank calculators, when I was young, and use those for exams. Maybe they're tools that can be used, but there's a real challenge with some of these AI systems that they might give a great result on some occasions, but they don't necessarily know when they've got it wrong, even.
I'm Ian Olson, working for an engineering company, GHD, and I'm a registered greenhouse and energy auditor, leading lots of audits and have done assurance of sustainability-related information for more than 20 years. And I'm kind of thinking, it's great, fantastic. Where were you guys 30 years ago? I would have loved this to have been a discussion 20 years ago. But my main thing here is they're saying, well, it's great that you do this standardization and thinking about independence and ethics, but a key question is competence. What is a material misstatement of a sustainability piece of information? When has a report failed? That's a significant decision that the assurance practitioner has to be able to make, and you cannot rely on an expert for that. Let's take an example. Let's take a BP Deepwater Horizon and say that this happens in the future and you have these things in place, and BP reports, as they did at the time, that there is no significant risk with deepwater drilling. That's what they communicated. And then these things happen. Where's the failure? So there was a failure at the decision making or on how that was reported, but there was probably also a failure of some auditor at some point that may not have been able to make the judgment call that that was a materially misstated piece of information. And that comes to competence of the auditor. So what are you going to do about that?
Yeah.
So I wish you'd been at our round table earlier. If you want to fly to Singapore on Monday, you can join in with that one. But absolutely fascinating, because my question is, what does a restatement look like on sustainability information, and what are the consequences of it? And of course we've got different tracks that come off that, because you could end up with a restatement of sustainability information because you are better informed and you have better insight and understanding that develops as a result of going through a process. Or as you say, you have it because there has been a failure, be it either of governance or oversight or assurance, that has resulted in information that is misleading. From our code's perspective, one of the fundamental principles of code is looking at professional competence and due skill and care. But we need to ensure that that can be applied in the context of these type of engagements. But I think it's a fantastic question to ask, and indeed one of the things that we take away from our round table in Sydney today is that thing of what are the consequences, and that's going to need a dialogue with the regulatory community to think about how it affects, as you say, the ultimate end user. And in those sorts of circumstances, and I think it plays into what Marge has said to us earlier, it's not just about the financial consequences of that, it's about the broader consequences on workforce, on the environment, on confidence in an industry to continue to provide stuff. So, you know, really grateful that you raised the point.
Okay, I think I'll close it off. Nobody's in a rush. So, Gary, thank you to the panel. If you can join me, thank you. To say a few words.
Great, thanks Chandler, and I was taking lots of notes trying to summarise some of the key points from what was said, but I think the first thing I want to highlight is just how privileged we all are here tonight to have, and I was writing down, we've got two members from the International Ethics Standards Board, one member of the International Audit Assurance Standards Board, we have the chair of the Australian Audit Assurance Standards Board. We have the chair of the Australian Accounting Professional Ethical Standards Board, as well as the CEO from that board. We have the chair of the New Zealand Audit Assurance Standards Board. We have the chief accountant from Australia's securities regulator. And then Mark also holds an executive role with the United Kingdom Financial Reporting Council. So in terms of the quality and expertise we have, it's been incredible. I hope you all felt quite privileged to be hearing from this group. But I think one thing that always happens when you have experts is you would have noticed a lot of acronyms. And I think, on reflection, we should have issued everyone a list of acronyms so that you could follow all of the conversation. And I recall when I joined IFAC, we were given a list of acronyms, and it used to be about 35 pages long. So there's lots of acronyms in this space. But I think if I were to summarise just four or five key points, one is the rapid evolution of the work that's happening. And although we heard from Carol and the last gentleman about, yeah, there's been a lot of reporting for a lot of years, I think in terms of the response from the regulatory community, from standard setters and everything, it is moving very quickly. And in fact, it's interesting, we did hear a couple of times about how quickly standards are being developed, and a lot of you will be saying that they're still talking 12 or 18 months, but that is really quick for international standards when you're trying to get agreement globally. And the pace of change in this area, it is quite amazing. But you've got to remember, we already have standards and requirements in New Zealand. We already have them in Europe. Even the US SEC has issued requirements in the United States. So I think that's the important thing. Things are happening really quickly. I think the second thing is, it is complex. You know, we heard from our speakers about, you know, quotes like, there's lots going on, it's bigger than what we've had before. And that leads to the fourth point, and that is, there are so many people involved. The collaboration and cooperation that's required and that is being undertaken, and importantly, both within and outside of the profession, and recognition that, you know, we in the profession, the accountancy profession, have to look outside and see what it is, and Marge, I think you've described that very well, that we need to embrace what is happening, recognise what is happening, and not just be focusing on it from a profession point of view. And you know, and Mark, I congratulate you again today on the IASBA roundtable, that we had a gentleman from the ISO speak about the ISO and involved in the discussions, because I think if the IASBA is going to develop something that's profession agnostic, well, it can't be the accounting profession developing something profession agnostic. It has to be as many people as we can involved in that process. And I think the second last point was the discussion around the importance of information, but then leading to, and I think nearly every panelist talked about trust, confidence, credibility, consistency, comparability, all those really important things that we need to have if we are going to have a truly, a system and a process and arrangements that do work for everyone. That is important, that people can make decisions based on. And although there's a lot of focus on financial impact and financial decisions, we've already had it highlighted that there are decisions beyond just the financial impacts that are really important. And the last thing, and it was mentioned also by a couple of our speakers, is climate change, and climate is only the beginning. It's climate first with what's happening, for example, with the ISSB. But we even talked about it at the round table, is that when you start looking at developing, you know, processes for assurance or ethical standards, we don't want to be here in 3 years' time thinking about things other than just climate change or sustainability. We already have reporting around modern slavery, human rights and other things like that. What the gentleman raised cryptocurrencies and other things that are happening. You know, we can't be trying to respond all the time to everything that's coming up every few years. And so to the extent that we can do the work now to make it as relevant and appropriate for all these emerging issues, I think it is going to be really important. So yeah, that was just sort of the key points that I got out of the discussion. I think the call to action, and I think, again, we heard it from several of our panelists, people need to be involved. You know, we need to be engaged. If you, in your organisations, are not already thinking about it, doing stuff about it, then you probably need to get going and get started. You know, we need to all be engaged and involved and work. And just the last thing I'd like to do before we take a recess and join us all for drinks and nibbles out in the area, and I'm pointing in that direction because as you go out the door, just move to the right. I do just want to say a big thank you to the panelists, to Nancy and Chana and the APSB, and to all the panelists, we just have a little thank you gift to say thank you for your participation today. But as Rupert, I suppose if you don't mind just handing them out, I'd just like everyone to join me in thanking our panelists again for a great session. And if you just follow what Melissa's...